Welcome back from the holiday weekend. Did you spend some time barbecuing with the family? Setting off fireworks? Perhaps coming dangerously close to setting one another on fire? That's typical. Being family is tricky business. One of the most treasured yet complex family relationships is siblinghood. Brothers and sisters figure out who they are in relation to one another, and they experience life's ups and downs together. So what are the building blocks for a healthy sibling dynamic? Join that conversation on Central Standard right after this news. Blood thicker than the mud. It's a family affair. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. Here with me to discuss sibling relationships is Bruce Lease. He's a psychologist and professor of family medicine at the University of Kansas Medical Center. And Bruce, we hear a lot about sibling rivalry, and that may well be a part of most sibling relationships. But today we want to focus on what we can do to keep these special bonds healthy and strong, because our brothers and sisters are the people who travel all the way through life with us, right?
That's great. Yes, that is accurate. Well, in a healthy family, that's true.
Describe for me the key traits of a healthy sibling relationship. What are some of the kinds of interactions you're likely to see?
Well, they're not that much different from most healthy relationships. They are warm and engaged and safe and pleasurable to be involved with. But that engagement part is probably one of the more important aspects of a good relationship.
Describe what you mean by engagement in this context.
Well, participating, whether not just in good times, but in good times and bad times through disagreements as well as agreements. I'm always skeptical about people who say they had a perfect childhood or they have a wonderful family and they can describe the fun things they did together, but there's no mention of how they got through the hard times.
Well, so describe what the conflict or disagreement, especially let's look at just little kids. What does a healthy level of conflict and disagreement among young siblings look like, and what maybe doesn't it look like?
Well, it is inevitable that there will be conflict. And so what it looks like is disagreements or challenges to them, each of them, for their parents' attention. Sharing resources, even things like the bathroom, not just possessions, but there's no home I've ever seen where kids didn't have to share resources, the same refrigerator, the same bathroom.
And to be fair, sharing a bathroom is difficult.
It is. I know adults that can't figure it out. Just temperament. There are differences in temperament between.
Explain that.
There truly are children who are calm and relaxed and quiet and sweet and kind of reflective. And there are kids who are energetic and rambunctious and love to talk and will be the first one to grab the cookies out of the cookie jar. So those are temperamental differences. It's you know, how they manifest their emotions outwardly, inwardly, et cetera. So differences, a lot of times a child who's less aggressive, even with a non-aggressive sibling, the more active sibling will get there first.
Oh, yeah, that sounds well. And I think that's just like any other relationship. If you had to cohabitate with someone with a major temperamental difference, someone who loves noise and you're kind of quiet, that would be difficult.
Yeah, it's difficult in some ways, but it's easier in other ways. I'll keep it to children. You know, two quiet children don't have anyone to kind of say, let's go watch TV even though we're supposed to be getting into bed
No instigator.
No instigator. But, there's balance that occurs when adults and children have different temperaments. And that balance can be great for the relationship and for their lives.
So as a psychologist, what would you say are the main indicators of sibling relationship quality?
The indicators of quality, warmth would be one of them, and conflict would be another. There are researchers who look specifically at the level of warmth between siblings and at the same time look at the level of conflict. There are very, very engaged, warm, brothers and sisters that also have a high degree of conflict. One minute they're really, you know, the older brother is taking the younger sister under their wing and helping them with their homework or their puzzle or whatever. So there can be a lot of warmth and also a lot of conflict, or a lot of warmth and little conflict, or there can be no warmth. It could just be kind of a cold, distant relationship with a lot of conflict or no conflict. So
if these things don't really exist necessarily on a spectrum with warmth at one end and conflict at the other, how do you use those things as a measure? Should both be high?
I think there are a lot of parents who say to people, if you're in the grocery store and somebody comes up to you as a parent and they say, oh, your kids get along so well, they're so good to each other, it's not uncommon to hear the parents say, well, you should see them at home, or you should see them when they're fighting over a toy, or to get to who gets to the sink to brush their teeth to get into bed and get the book read to them first. So, you know, kids can be really loving and sweet, and then they can fight like cats and dogs, and that's not uncommon, and it's easy to spot by the parent.
So are the things that you've just described true of sibling relationships at any age, even in adulthood, or do we need to look at stages of siblinghood? It would probably be indicative of a much larger problem for, say, hair pulling to occur among adults.
I have watched some very, very tragic results of poor sibling relationships. And when I say tragic, I am exposed to things like brothers and sisters suing each other over business, you know, issues, or brothers and sisters just never talking to each other again, or just horrible, terrible lifespan developmental moments like going to a wedding and a brother and sister ruining the wedding because, you know, they will not talk to each other or they'll argue with each other. Funerals, you know, where people are brought together and adult brothers and sisters misbehave.
Man, well, so let's work through some of these stages of siblinghood. I'm thinking maybe the teenage years mark a shift from those early childhood kinds of things, right?
Well, it's interesting that you say that because a lot of times sibling problems will occur between two siblings that are at different periods in their lives. So one might be a teenager and the other one actually might be a preteen, and the preteen may want to hang around the teenager more than the teenager wants. So you ask the question about how, the lifespan development of a child affects things. When they're different pseudo-generations, that's even impactful.
Yeah, a few years can make such a big difference at around that time.
Yeah, I think once you get if you have two teenagers, it's easy, especially after they hit 17 years old, 16, 17, they can probably easily escape each other. But it can be awful when they're really young and they're stuck together. I recently spoke to somebody who said their solution to their kids fighting tooth and nail, I mean, really hurting each other, their solution
was physical fighting.
Physical fighting,
yeah.
Bloodshed, the whole works, and I'm not being, it's not hyperbole. Their solution was to make the kids stay in a room until they worked it out, and it only got worse. And I suspect that the kids I'm talking about won't be sitting together enjoying, a wedding together, a cousin's wedding. I think they'll probably be sitting at opposite ends of the room.
You know, I read a book, Animals in Translation, by Temple Grandin a few years back, and it's about animals. But one of the things she writes about is how young puppies kind of fight with each other and play fight, partly to figure out how much aggression is too much aggression, how much is hurtful, that one puppy bites another, and that when the other yelps, that's the sign, okay, that was too hard. And they learn that when they're little and sort of undangerous. Is there an analogy like that for kids, or is that just a poor analogy?
That's a great analogy. Children who have siblings, where they grow up, the children who are siblings in a healthy home, really learn how to share, how to negotiate, how to communicate effectively when they have to share scarce resources. When one of them yelps, the other one backs off and apologizes. How's that for approving of your analogy?
Well, no, that's good. So as they move into a later stage, have they done maybe all the yelping they need to in a healthy scenario? Or is that something you continue to work out with your siblings, like how to negotiate things in a safe space?
You know, when people have the skills for dealing with conflict, the conflicts don't go away, but the poisonous, the toxic part of the conflicts don't exist. That's pretty much the way it is. They're going to be conflicts, but they're worked through to healthy outcomes.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman speaking with Bruce Leese, with us from the University of Kansas Medical Center. He's a psychologist and professor of family medicine there. And we are talking about sibling bonds. Call us to share your sibling stories and conundrums. We especially want to hear about siblings who turned corners in their relationships. What changed and why? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again is 816-235-2888. And Bruce, when you think about little kids, mostly we meet our siblings when parents bring a new child home from wherever the child has been born. But that, does that bond form immediately? Is it in the blood, so to speak? Or do siblings require time to connect and feel close and maybe experience something together?
Well, to put it in perspective, even adults, even healthy adults, don't immediately bond to this little stranger that's entered into their lives.
Little bundle of biological functions.
Right, exactly. And there are moms and dads, even moms who have, have carried the baby through, term to pregnancy, don't quite know what to do with a child sometimes. Some moms sometimes, some dads sometimes. So if an adult struggles with it, you can imagine that other siblings do. And so how the adults teach children from that moment, that I'm glad you picked bringing the child home from the hospital because, that's where the learning really starts. Some people really try to prepare their kids well in advance, but there's nothing like the real thing to make a difference.
Yeah.
So, it's a difficult transition.
And how does the arrival of the new sibling affect the development of a little one who has up until this point been either an only child or the youngest child?
Totally depends on how the parents, it's important to note here that children learn to understand the entire world around them by what their parents say is going on. So parents who tell children what's going on effectively around them will have children that can handle what's going on around them.
I know you can't share things from your clinical experiences, but can you sort of in general terms paint the picture of a child being brought home and everything kind of going well and a child being brought home and everything going not so well?
Well, let me say this and I will answer your question. Psychologists who teach like I do and research and write, we do composites. We take, we take a whole group of children and turn them into one. So the name, the gender, everything is totally different, and they're a giant mixed group. So when I tell you that I can tell you about a patient, it is not ever one patient. So,
okay.
Sure. So ask the question again, and I'll answer it.
Okay. Tell a story about a family bringing home a new bundle of joy and things going really, really well with the existing sibling group that's there or the only other child who's there. And then maybe paint the picture in a way that it's maybe unfolding in a way that's setting the stage for not so good stuff.
Sure. I'll do it behavior by behavior. So, mom and dad or mom or dad or mom and mom or dad and dad bring a child home. And the child that lives there, is so excited that they grab the child and they want to pull the child out of the car seat. And the parents go, precious here is delicate and you got to be really careful. And the kid yells and screams, hi, hi, hi. And the baby starts to cry and they explain, little humans are delicate and you have to be careful. So in the good scenario, there's a sensitivity by the parents to, the delicacy, the delicateness of another human.
And it sounds like of the older child who also just doesn't understand this yet.
Right. But then the baby becomes, the baby's teething and they bite the arm of the child who's older. And the parents say to the baby, no biting. It goes both ways. So it's teaching children to be sensitive to other human beings and to promote safety and security and love in the family.
And it sounds like also being present enough to observe these things and intervene with an adult awareness of what's going on.
You could not have said that better. You really could not have. That is just absolutely the biggest crime some parents commit, and that's not being attentive or attuned or sensitive to what's going on.
Well, let's hear from Heather, who has called us to talk about her experiences. Hi, Heather.
Hi. I'm actually one of three. I'm the middle child, and I get along really well now. I've had my ups and downs with my siblings, but I get along great now with my siblings. I live here, though, and my husband has two brothers and a sister, and the brother that's closest to him in age, they were always really close, but ever since my husband and I started dating, he's hated me. And it's gotten to the point now where my parents are funding my attorney to get a restraining order against him and his family.
Wow.
And we are actually getting to the point where we're getting ready to sell our business and we're moving back to where my family's from because the situation is so toxic that we can't go anywhere socially because they went to the same high school without questions being asked and the rumors that have been spread about me and my husband's relationship and all this other stuff coming to a head and people whispering and just people just outright asking questions. Like, my mechanic will know if I'm taking an antidepressant or what's going on. You know, my mechanic will know things that he shouldn't know because my brother-in-law will do things. And the straw that broke the camel's back was recently where he had sent out emails to everyone that we knew and calling people that he didn't even live in this country, that are family members, because my husband's British, to let them know that because of an affair that I was supposedly having, because I work with males, that the baby that I was pregnant with was not my husband.
Wow.
So
this is all pretty intense, Heather.
Yeah, it's intense. And so now we're like to the point where this is so toxic. My family just doesn't do this. Like, we don't just not talk to each other for years on end and do this kind of thing. And so I'm not used to this. And I just said, you know, either the only way to get rid of him is to either move or I have to divorce you if I can't get rid of him other way.
Well,
we have to pick.
Let's let Bruce Lease talk about this a little bit, because there are many things that we could discuss about Heather's scenario. But one of the things that's interesting is that it sounds like a sibling group that had gotten along well as children got along less well, dramatically so, as adults. Is that a thing that happens often?
Yeah, I believe that's true. I think so many, as part of transitions through life and normal lifespan development, people change their values and they change their attitudes and they change their beliefs. And kids who were born to conservative or liberal families have been known to go the opposite direction. And so, you know, if the family and friends don't come with them, there go the family and friends. But speaking more directly to Heather's points, you know, I think researchers on this topic agree that...
And this topic being maybe like new...
family relationships, sibling relationships,
okay.
You know, how brothers and sisters get along. And even in-laws, we could pull in-laws into that.
Yeah, because it sounds like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are very, I've read over and over again, them described as intense, emotionally intense relationships. And to explain that further, you know, even non-family, non-committed relationships can be difficult. If you go to the store and you believe that the item you are buying is on sale and the clerk says, no, it's not. It's not uncommon for somebody to feel irritated at the clerk, and that's not even your family. Now, imagine, and I think this is why the divorce rate is so high, being in a mandatory relationship, that's supposed to be characterized by love and cooperation and forgiveness. If you didn't like that the clerk didn't give you the price you thought you were supposed to get, what about when you're planning this big, you know, holiday party and the in-law plans a party directly opposed to your party on the same date? I mean, the potential because of the mandatory closeness for disagreements and struggles and upset.
And the
is
mandatory
huge.
Closeness without the history.
Without the history. And the history could make it worse, though. But I could easily see in-law. That's why there's so many jokes about in-laws, mother-in-laws, son-in-laws, daughter-in-laws, etc.
And I just want to say I have wonderful in-laws. I don't want them listening and thinking that we're bashing in-laws in general here. But so in-laws, though, create new wrinkles in existing relationships, too, not just between the person who has married in and their spouse's relationships, but the spouse, him or herself, with his own parents or with his own brothers in this case.
Well, let's make it even more complicated. In-laws and also blended families. You know, what you're doing is bringing unrelated people together and mandating that they claim to care about each other. Sometimes there may even be a demand to love each other. There may be demands to like each other. And those are not realistic necessarily. It's not necessarily true that that will ever happen for some families.
Okay, well, let's turn now to Reggie in Shawnee. Hi, Reggie.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What can you share?
Hey, I was wondering, the pecking order of siblings.
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. You mean age?
Yeah.
Birth?
Yeah, and age.
let me say this. Thank you for the call, Reggie. I, as part of preparation for today, of course, pored over everything I could find on sibling relationships. And over again, what I expected was true. There is absolutely no strong, consistent, validated over and over again research that shows that it makes a difference. Now here's what's good to know. In your family, my family,
a specific family,
any specific family, of course, the order might be very important. I find that the order has more to do with what's going on with the parents during that period of time. You know, a kid can be born into a family that has no good resources. They're poor. They are struggling, and then the next kid in the same family, now the parents are doing really well, or a kid can be born into a family that has money, and then they lose it all in a recession. So, environmental circumstances, how the parents are getting along, those impact children way more than whether they are the youngest or the eldest. So,
Reggie, what's your experience?
Well, what happened when I was younger, my older sister, she's 4 years older than me, you know, she was supposed to babysit. And it worked out well when I was younger, but as I got older, the discipline began to be fights.
So the sister as disciplinarian.
Right. And she should not have been in that role. I don't believe that she should have been in that role, but that's what happened. And, I mean, it's so bad to the point that one time she chased me outside. I ran around the house and got back in and locked her out, and it was cold. And once my mom got home, well, I got in trouble. But we don't have a great relationship to this day, and it seemed like from that point, and that's why I brought the pecking order. It's like I think I overstepped my boundary as being the youngest and really made her feel inferior. However, being a male, is that how it's supposed to go? And I just wanted to hear what you had to say on that. And I'm going to get off of here. And I appreciate this show.
Thanks, Reggie.
Yes, thank you very much. You raise very good questions from age, which we addressed, to the question you just raised about a child being responsible for taking care of another child. Children in some families end up with more responsibility than they should have. It happens a lot, unfortunately. There are children who become breadwinners in their family because the family doesn't have one. There are children who become parents in their families because the parents are gone for a number of reasons, necessity, financial, or even for the worst reasons, which are, all kinds of mental illnesses and irresponsible behaviors. So a child should never, ever be put in a position where they are responsible for the development of the character of their siblings. So, yeah, babysitting for an evening so your parents can go out and have fun is great and normal and healthy and wonderful. But as soon as it turns into the feeling or the belief by an older child that they are in charge of character development or disciplinary actions, that is totally inappropriate, and children are completely unprepared for that kind of thing.
With both Heather and Reggie, something that I wonder about is these sibling relationships between adults that had seeds planted long ago for discord and difficulty and really conflict, intense conflict. Is there something that people can do to take matters back in their own hands, or is that just too deeply ingrained to overcome?
We did one of the Central Standard shows on forgiveness. And my thought immediately goes to forgiveness. It is so wrong to carry resentments through life. It benefits no one. Disengagement, distance benefits no one. At the very least, people who are upset with each other would benefit greatly from complete and total forgiveness. That doesn't mean acceptance of what the other person did or whatever, but it's an attitude that is part of being a mature, healthy adult. So yes, people can take these things into their own hands simply by forgiving the anyone, including themselves, for any perceived wrongdoing.
But doesn't that forgiveness have to go two ways? And maybe you can't make the other person forgive you back.
It's interesting. Optimally, ideally, it will go both ways. If it doesn't, the forgiver, the person forgiving the sibling, is going to gain mental health by doing so. So even if the other one doesn't, that's okay.
Well, let's hear from Bill in Lawrence. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Please go on.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello? Hi. How are you?
Great. What is your story for us?
Well, I'm an identical twin, and I had a brother that is a complete opposite.
Bill, did you say an identical twin?
Yes.
Ah, okay. That brings up interesting dynamics.
Okay, go on. Sorry.
Yes, and we when we were growing up, I mean, he would steal things from our friends, and he if he did something around the house, broke something, or rolling a wall or whatever, he'd never own up to it. Never, you know, no matter what. And so, consequently, we both got punished for whatever happened, you know. If I did something, got in trouble, I would always own up for it, but he never would. And later in life, he got into heroin, got into crack cocaine, and wound up, before that, though, he actually took my parents' car and wrecked it and put it back in the garage and never told him about it, and then wouldn't own up to it, you know. It's like, you know, it's just been that way all his life. And,
Bill, how's your relationship now?
Well, now that he's older and he's paying the dues for the way he lived, he's in a wheelchair, and he's... So, anyway, I've pretty much take care of him during the day, and I just feel sorry for him, you know.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Bill.
All right. I just want to know if that's common for
people. No, I'm glad you asked that question. Bill, that was a very moving story, and I congratulate you on having the humanitarian attitude you have to take care of somebody who struggled that much and probably disrupted your life. Let me make it really simple here. When a good psychologist takes a history from somebody to try to figure out how they're going to help them, they do ask, what were the parents like? And the first words out of many patients' mouths is, you know, I don't want to blame my parents. But in fact, parents are responsible for raising their kids effectively. And it's a very, very, very difficult job to raise kids well. And I have to say, from 30 plus years of experience and lots of studies, that parents allow those kinds of things to happen. And the kids who aren't in trouble suffer as much as the person who's in trouble. So thank you so much for sharing that, Bill.
Yes, thank you. And we want more callers to go ahead and share their sibling stories at 816-235-2888 when we get back from the break. This is Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be back in a few. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm here with Bruce Leese from the University of Kansas Medical Center. He's a professor of family medicine and a psychologist, and he's been sharing with us his insights into good, healthy sibling relationships and maybe how to transform some relationships that aren't that way into that kind of sibling relationship. The number to call if you want to join the conversation is 816-235-2888, either your own sibling story or your children's. If you're a parent working to sort of separate the healthy sibling bickering from maybe something that isn't so healthy, 816-235-2888. And Bruce, before we went to break, we were talking about a scenario where one of our callers is actually an identical twin, and he had a very sad story about himself and his brother, but twins seem to me that they are probably a special case.
Yeah, they are a special case. That's why so much research is done on twins. You often hear the term twin study. Because they share the same genetic makeup, it can be assumed that they share the same potential for disease, and that includes mental illness, etc. And even temperament is going to be, you know, somewhat shared. But there are still differences. The nature-nurture argument, so-called nature-nurture, is the argument that, oh, it's nature that did this to a child, their parents nurtured this. So what a parent nurtures in a child is going to be different from what it nurtures in another child. What a parent will effect in one child will be different from what they affect another child, no matter what their genetic makeup is. So, you know, a child who grows up with an identical twin is going to have parents that don't treat them exactly the same, and so there can be differences. I've always been told by twins that they feel each other's emotions, and I'm not surprised, and I don't doubt it. I've even been told by a number of twins that when their identical twin was in another city or state and having a problem, they could tell. So I can happily say I don't know the research on that, because it's really kind of fun speculating about what it must be like to be a twin.
And what about another kind of special sibling relationship? I'm thinking of step siblings and half siblings, which in many cases have a lot of the characteristics of full siblings, but with some differences built in.
If parents handle the process of blending the family, it's going to go well. If they have raised great kids who love well and who are good and kind and smart with each other, then it will all be okay. And if they raise kids who have emotional problems or communications deficits or are selfish or mean, you know, they're not going to get along that well. There will be competition. So it's how the parents act.
I have stepsisters, and I think one thing that's interesting to me about that relationship is that we were there for all sorts of things that happened to one another, but we weren't necessarily involved. So if they went through something that involved a part of their family that wasn't really part of my family, I was there to witness it, but not to be wrapped up in it, and vice versa. And I think that's a really interesting and unique kind of relationship. And I wonder if there's been a lot of research into that.
There hasn't been a lot of research into that part of being a blended family. I'm glad you raised that, because in all that I looked at, here's the deal. If you are in a blended family, which most Americans are in, a family where there's been divorce and remarriage, it all depends on how you operate as people, you know, before you get married, before you meet each other, and how the circumstances occurred that you got together as a blended family. So all that matters way more than whether you were biologically connected.
I have one more of my own questions. I'm being selfish here. We'll get back to the calls in just a second. But this, something that you hear a lot, a phrase that's coming under scrutiny, is boys will be boys. And then there have been books and movies, I'm thinking specifically about Tina Fey's Mean Girls, about the specific girl competition kinds of dynamics. And I wonder if there is any truth to this idea that boys and girls have conflict differently.
Oh, they do. There's no question about it. You know, we live in a society where boys are encouraged to be strong and not cry and not demonstrate any vulnerability or have pain. You know, look at the sports we're excited about, football and soccer, where people not, where typically men knock each other all over the place and we jump up and applaud and we're all excited that they've hurt each other. Women are not raised that way in our country. They're raised to be, and this is well validated in research, more communicators, more nurturing. I heard on NPR today that women's businesses that are started by women are generally more trusted. So, you know, women are taught to be nurturing and to listen to each other. Men, culturally, are not necessarily.
So does that affect brothers versus sisters and how those relationships typically evolve?
Well, in my imagination, I picture step and half sisters arguing about, you know, whose new blouse that is. I don't imagine boys arguing about, although I'm sure it happens. So
maybe arguing about different stuff.
I can only answer that out of my own imagination.
All right. Let's hear from Mary in Leawood. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
I'm calling as a parent of a 9-year-old and 11-year-old. My son is the 11-year-old, my daughter's the 9-year-old, and they are within 2 years of each other, and it seems like they are just constantly having conflict. And I grew up in a family where there was more separation in age between me and my sister, so to an extent, what I'm experiencing with my kids might be normal for their kind of close age, but essentially, you know, my there is no pecking order in this family. My younger daughter doesn't recognize that there's any authority from the older brother, and the older brother tends to have a bad reaction to his younger sister's kind of precocious and aggressive personality. And even though they don't physically fight with each other, there's a lot of kind of back and forth and cutting words. And, you know, I'm constantly encouraging them to be kind, but, you know, there's just too much rivalry. There's too much competition. And with their age being what it is, they're just around each other all the time. And I think overexposure is probably something that is factoring in to their dynamic just being kind of heavy with conflict. And I want to kind of make sure I'm ushering them into, you know, the rest of their life together as siblings without there being kind of a long-lasting resentment and sort of a setup for a bad relationship in the future.
Bruce, what do you think?
Okay. Thank you, Mary, for calling. That's perfect. You're allowing me to address things I wanted to mention. First of all, a 9- and 11-year-old don't have sufficiently developed abstraction skills. Even though they sound like little adults, they are not. And the whole idea that we can encourage kids to be kind at that age is unrealistic. They go, yeah, yeah, mom, yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to, you know, to pull her hair or, you know, to yell at her. But they don't really get it at a deep level. They're not cognitively well developed. So
that's interesting. So when we, as 10 and 11-year-old little humans, are pulling each other's hair, we aren't fully grasping that we're hurting another person?
They don't understand the concept of kind. If I asked 100, you know, middle-aged people what is kindness, I'd have 100 different variations of what it is. So now, with no context, you know, with no context at all to put it in outside of their own little home, a 9- and 11-year-old just won't get kindness. I mean, if you have a new puppy, kindness means you don't yank its tail, you don't fling it around the room, you know. But those constructs, the biggest mistake, particularly, and I don't mean politically, just emotionally, liberal parents, again, it's not a political concept, but liberal parents who want to be really not too punitive to their kids, they want to raise their kids to be understanding and sweet. The idea that you can tell kids what kindness is at that age, it doesn't sink in as well as you might imagine.
So what do you say instead?
Time out. You are in time out. You're both in time out. I am certain, and it's good because in reviewing the research on this, I've stumbled over the University of Michigan's work on this very area of discipline to minimize. Discipline of children to minimize sibling rivalry, and they present very strict guidelines. And I say I feel good about that because that's what I've always encouraged parents to do. Stop. And my old friend Ed Christofferson, who is a pediatric psychologist here in town, is just brilliant. You know, he said you don't negotiate with kids over how they treat each other, how they treat people, or how they act. Now you have to impose upon them rules like, you do, when I hear your voice raised, I don't care who started it, a scream is a scream and you are in timeout for the number of minutes per life. So parents that have kids that don't treat each other well, who are preteens especially, should stop thinking that having a good talk with them will matter at all. It is the willingness to put your kid in timeout and say, you will not talk to people that way. Not your sister, not your brother, not adults, nobody. So it's just, and it's so, so powerful.
Yeah.
In my practice, I would say that the success rate of parents who follow those kinds of rules is nears 100, because kids are completely dependent on their parents to give them, you know, rewards and to make their lives wonderful or to make their lives more punitive when they misbehave. So, Mary, no more encouraging your kids to be kind. Time out as soon as either of them acts aggressively towards the other. It doesn't matter who started. And oftentimes they'll both be in timeout. That will be fine.
And Mary also mentioned how far apart the kids are in age. Does that have really a qualitative effect, or is that?
Absolutely not. You know, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's nothing in any research that would support the idea that 2 years matters, 4 years matters. You know, what about the 16-year-old whose, you know, 12-year-old sibling walks into their room while they're making out with their boyfriend or girlfriend? I mean, age span only creates different problems, not bigger or smaller problems. Can you imagine the screaming of the 16-year-old?
Is there something that kind of interests me, too, is not just quantity of fighting, but kind of quality of fighting? Are there different kinds of sibling squabbling, sort of qualitatively?
Yes, I encourage siblings to squabble. I encourage them to say, you promised you wouldn't do that, or you, a sibling telling another sibling you're chewing too loud is really terrific if it's not an aggressive attacking act. You know,
I'm relieved to hear that, because I actually did utter those words to my younger brother.
Right. I mean, that's the beauty of having a sibling. You get feedback from another human who's around your age that kind of helps you process the norms of society. And it's just terrific to have small squabbles.
Let's hear from Paul in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I was just telling the producer, my wife thought she had found the perfect answer to get our three sons, one in junior high, one high school, one in sixth grade, to be nice to each other, because they never were. So at the dinner table, she said, okay, boys, I do not want to hear one word out of any of you unless you have something nice to say to your brothers. Our sixth grader looked at his brothers and smiled and said, you're two of the nicest dumb kids I know.
Oh, man.
This kind of validates the idea that kindness as an abstraction is not necessarily understood by this age group, right, Paul?
Right.
Well, thanks for that story. I hope that it sounds
sure.
Like at least those kids have a great sense of humor.
Oh, my goodness. I am, my mouth hurt. My face hurts from my smiling in response to your call, Paul. Besides being a psychologist and a professor, I also occasionally get to teach sailing, which is, you know, a pretty innocuous sport. You just go out. But I teach sailing on occasion to couples. And I love this, or I don't love this. I'll have husbands and wives on a sailboat yelling at each other like two kids. And I'll say to them, unless you have something nice to say to each other, don't say anything. And half the time they just don't say anything. You know, it's really kind of, I'm laughing, but just following Paul's story. So learning to teaching children who then become adults to be kind, as Mary mentioned earlier, is a good thing. But it doesn't happen by negotiating with kids. It happens by adults or teenagers being taught over and over again. It doesn't pay to be mean, and it does pay to be kind. So modeling. I recently talked to a parent. The circumstances were pretty interesting. I was on an airplane. I recently talked to a parent that said, my kids fight so much that we won't even hear it, but we'll walk into the bedroom because it's been quiet for too long, and they'll be bleeding, you know, from punching each other out. And I said, well, what have you tried to do to solve the problem? And the parents said on the airplane, well, we put them in the room together and they have to work it out, which is a terrible idea, alone together. It's a terrible idea because where are they going to learn the skills? They just beat each other up. There's no new inpouring of skills. So I said, if that didn't work, what else did you try? And they said, nothing works. And I said, do you and your husband fight? And she said, all the time. Well, you know, people who want wonderful kids have to be wonderful adults. They can't be. If parents want siblings that get along great, they need to demonstrate to their kids that they can, with their spouses or significant others or whatever, that they can resolve conflict in very positive, constructive, caring, engaged ways. So when the kids sit at the dinner table and they see the parents engaged with each other and disagreeing on something and working through it, they think, wow, I guess that's how it works. But it doesn't work when you just stick them together in a room, and it doesn't work when you yell and scream at them. And no matter what good you do for your kids, if there's pain and suffering in the parents, kids will manifest that often by hurting each other.
You mentioned how adult relationships affect children and sibling relationships, but also I'm interested in how sibling relationships can manifest in adulthood. Like you mentioned the couples on the sailboat sailing. Is that kind of conflict informed by what people did when they were kids with their siblings, or does that set a stage in some ways for our conflict resolution as adults?
A while ago during this show, I said that people claim that they had a perfect childhood. They don't understand why they have all these problems now. A perfect childhood is characterized by not just material comfort, but also the comfort of parents that get along really well and discipline their kids, balancing consequences with nurturing and warmth. And I'll see a lot of well-off people who were raised in middle-class, upper-middle-class homes who are miserable as adults. The worst thing that happens to people who have difficult sibling relationships, have parents that fight with each other, the worst thing that happens to them is that they don't love well. So they'll get in a relationship, even on a sailboat, they'll get in a relationship where they just never learned how to be, to use that word again, kind and cooperative and engaged even through a difficult moment. They haven't learned that. So if siblings know how to fight only and they don't know how to love well, they're going to go into adulthood and have relationship problems. They may earn $1 million a year and they may live in a perfectly beautiful home and drive an expensive car, but it's going to be hard for them to adjust to love and relationships.
Let's hear from Kim in Peculiar. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good morning. Growing up, there were four of us, and Mom always said, we got along great, we played together. We had our squabbles, you know, but we played great together. And Mom had always commented as we got older that, you know, other parents would call and say, well, can one of us go play or can one of her kids come over? And a lot of times Mom would say, well, no, because they're playing so well together, I'm not going to put another one in the mix. And those other parents, she said, they were always so shocked because their kids didn't get along. And it was just kind of expected of us that we would get along. And I'm experiencing the same thing with my kids. I have three of them. They, of course, they squabble, they're kids, but they play together well and they have fun together. And they, you know, there's not a whole lot of turmoil, I guess you could say.
At the risk of getting in trouble for this, I'll make the statement that I imagine that you and your husband or your partner get along fine and model that for them. And I'll also speculate that there's nurturing in your home, but there are also some rules and discipline. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Whew, good, because I was sweating there for a moment.
Well, Bruce, what can Kim's story, how can it instruct us? I mean, it is a little sad that her community finds this a surprising scenario, that these kids get along.
It instructs us simply by reminding us that when you raise kids with a balance of love or nurturing and discipline, and they're not allowed to be awful and terrible, that they, you know, they're going to turn out well. Kim, I would, after giving you that great reinforcement myself, I would say, you know, have other kids over because your kids will be a good model. And also, there is the risk of kids getting along with their siblings so well that they don't get enough exposure to kids with problems. So heterogeneity, you know, mixed groups, well integrated, different families and ages and all that is good for kids. So drag a few of the neighbors in to play with your kids. It'll be good for them all.
I was interested in that idea that we aren't going to sully these waters.
Yeah, it's good for everyone to have differences, to be exposed to differences as they are growing up.
Let's very quickly, Jane, we just have a second, but if you want to get a last story in here, we'd love to hear from you. Jane in Leawood.
Hi. Yes, I have three older brothers. So we're all, you know, adults now, and our parents recently passed away, and just prior to their passing away, a lot of conflict surfaced regarding, you know, estate issues. There are probably other things under it, but so it's been pretty heated.
Yeah, Bruce.
I can jump in on that one easily. Estate issues should be discussed. My wife and I just told our 26-year-old, you know, what she can expect. We have three girls when we're gone, and that stuff should be addressed while parents are still healthy, and the parents should then mediate the emotional responses. So, yeah, that can be a mess if parents don't take care of that early.
Well, like we said, sibling relationships go with us all through life, so it's new things at every turn. That's all the time we have for this great conversation with psychologist Bruce Leese, who visits us on a monthly basis from the University of Kansas Medical Center. Thank you for your time, Bruce, as always.
I love being here.
Tune
You're
in
like a sister to me.
We'll have to squabble about that later. Tune in again tomorrow for a roundtable of artists discussing how aging affects the creative process and the artistic life. We'll hear from a visual artist, a jazz musician, and a ballet dancer. Don't miss it. To listen back to today's show or any previous conversations you've heard on Central Standard, just go to kcur.org/Central Standard. Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross are the producers of Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today's show. Stick around for Up to Date with Steve Kraske, coming up next.